So when the factory, it went through turbulent times, of course, too, didn't it? You know?
It did. I mean, you couldn't. First of all, the pulp mill closed. You couldn't make profit on it. The energy costs were too dear, and that pulp that they made there was used for making newspaper and cheaper products. It was very unrefined wood pulp, and you couldn't make profit with that, so that ceased. And then it was just generally small paper mill. Oh, some of the machines were kept up to date, but you just couldn't make profit in it. So that was it. Closed. Sold to somebody for a pound. End of story.
Was that heartbreaking for your father?
Claudia was best pleased about it, but I mean, that's it. Life goes on, and at that stage they had other companies in the group, so it just, that was the end of it. I mean, things change. You can make profit for a while, and then if you're not making a profit, you have to close it down. There's no point in going on.
Yeah.
So, end of story.
But did he try? Did he try?
Of course. You try everything, yeah. And you try changing, and you try different products and get different things. But as long as your base costs are out of line with what you're getting for what you're making, you're competing with Scandinavians who had vast machines that turn it out by, compared to a small little place like that. Like, you have specialty machines and they might make money, but in the long run, it's not a viable operation, so it closed.
But there was a lot. There was a knock-on effect here, because you know, if the factory didn't survive, the people around it.
Well, by then a lot of people didn't live right beside it, because I mean, what are you talking? When did that happen? The '70s, the early '80s? I can't remember. Yeah, people travelled then. Everybody had a car. Well, not everybody had a car, but it wasn't as intrinsically part of the town or the village, as we call it. It was more people travelled in, so you didn't see. You saw the effect when the maintenance strike was on in the, I don't know, late 50s, possibly 59, 50, 60, someplace in around that, when all the maintenance workers in Dublin went out on strike. I don't know what it was about, money, I presume. But when that happened and the factory was closed for ages, months and months, then it affected the village, because a lot of people lived right locally. But after that, like, by the time you get into the 70s, people are travelling for work, so it's not as devastating. And then there was other jobs you could go to at that time anyway, although some people probably never worked again.
And also I would imagine that if you spend something all your life, if you do something all your life to build something up, and then just to have to turn around and sell it for a pound afterwards.
Yeah, it's not easy.
It's not easy.
Yeah. But, I mean, such is life. It happens. Worst things happen.
Yeah. What happened to your dad then after that? What did he do?
Well, he worked down a bit as a director for a while, because they had the other companies in the group, and then he got involved in some kind of thing the Justice Department were running for buildings, a building for second chance for drug addicts when they come out of prison. They built a house, a centre for them up in Neilstown. They actually called it Cusack House. He was involved in that, and he was involved in the Chamber of Commerce. He was involved with Meals on Wheels. And generally, he was involved in his garden and his grandchildren, and that's about it.
So he continued life in that sense.
Yes.
In a very charitable way too, was it? Do you think, in the kind of stuff he was doing?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's giving back something to the community if he was of use.
Yeah.
So that's it.
And tell me about memorabilia, photographs, documents, anything like that. Do they survive?
I don't think there's anything. Dad wasn't one for keeping bits and pieces of history, so I don't think so.
Was he not? Yeah.
No. I told you, he wasn't interested in history, that kind of history. Just get on with it, do the job, get on with it.
Yeah, yes. Okay, tell me, what have you here?
Oh, they're just job offers that Dad got in January 1937 when he was offered a job as assistant to general manager when they were, I don't know, restarting or revitalising the paper mills in Clondalkin. The letters are signed by Ernest Blyde, who was secretary of the company, and offering him a job there after he had trained with some paper manufacturers in Scotland.
Oh, so he would have spent his apprentice or his learning years over there, would he, in Scotland?
Well, he had his engineering degree from UCD, which he had got with first-class honours and all sorts of scholarships, etc. And then he'd worked for the ESB for 6 months, and then he got this job offer. And because he had no experience papermaking, he was being sent over to Bertram and Sons over in Edinburgh, who were a paper manufacturer where he was trained. You know, he could see how all the different paper making up. So he was offered £3 a week when he was training, rising to £4 a week when he started work in Clondalkin, and with a promise of increments and further increases as the value of his, as his value to the company increases. And okay, that's what.
Okay, the address here when he came home is.
He was working in Northbridge, George Street. His uncle, Christopher Albert Cusack, after whom he was named, he was the dispensary doctor for the inner city and the north inner city at the time. And they lived on Northbridge, George Street, number 6. And he just stayed with uncle while he was at UCD, and for a short while afterwards, when he was working for the ESB, when he was in Dublin, he stayed there. But when he came back from Scotland, he rented Raheen House. He stayed with the two sisters at the top of the Monastery Road, whose name I can't forget. The Hanlon sisters.
Okay.
And then he rented Raheen House from farmers, I can't remember what the name of the farmer's name was that had that house.
Was it O'Brien?
Could be O'Brien, yeah. Could be O'Brien.
And is that where you were born?
Yeah.
And you must tell me then about his brother. You mentioned his brother inside in Dublin.
No, uncle.
Or sorry, yeah, your uncle, but his brother.
No, his uncle.
Oh, his uncle.
My great-uncle.
Yeah. And tell me about, what was your great-uncle's name?
Christopher Albert.
And what was he doing?
Dispensary doctor.
Oh, was he? At the time?
Yeah.
And so when your father came here, then he settled down in, and that's when things started to get going, I suppose.
I know nothing of that early history of the place. Yeah. It's all a mystery to me.
Is it? And like you said, he never brought his business home. He never discussed anything.
No, he had no time for history at all. He would totally disapprove of all this crack of recording everything. Move on, get on with the new, get into the future, don't be looking back.
But
a load of old rubbish history, his opinion.
Was there a time though that, as you say, he was totally dedicated, passionate about his work and what he was doing?
Oh yes, 7 days a week.
Yes, indeed. And so it must have, when it came to a stage, I suppose, where he was, you know, if you look at the dates on the letter, 1937, it's even before the war years. So he would have been kind of running that factory during the war years.
Oh, yeah. During the war years, they had to transform everything. Like the boiler house had to change from whatever oil it was running on, or electricity, I'm not sure which, to run on turf, which was all wet, soggy turf that was always available. So they had to reconfigure the power supplies and that down there. So that wasn't easy. And you couldn't get spare parts. So I presume the men in the machine, in the engineering part of it, made new tools or new parts, because you couldn't get new parts because everything was in the war effort.
And did he encourage any, during the war years, did he if staff wanted to go off and join the war, did he obviously didn't.
That's history. I know history. Nothing.
All right. Yes.
No, I wouldn't know anything because he wouldn't say. And I mean.
And was so, the other part of the business too would have been socialising and would he have encouraged, you know, to because there was such a large staff there and to try and get everybody, there was a happy atmosphere within in the place, was there? At the
I've
time?
No idea. You'd have to ask other people that. I wouldn't know that at all, Morris.
For the short time you were there, Anne, you went in. Was it just seasonal work, or did you go in?
No, I think two people were away from the office, and I had been working for an accountant in Canada, so I was asked to just do it for a short while they were sick, and then I stayed on and I studied and I left.
Can you
so it was 3 years, I think, that's all.
Yeah, just in your section, it was administration work, was it? Were you typing or were you...
It was in the cost accounting office. So I working out how much pulp they used every week and chemicals and what things cost and putting prices on things and working out what sections are profitable and what sections aren't, so on and so forth. Just general clerical sort of work.
And the staff there that worked with you, do you recall who they were?
Tom O'Carroll and Colm Goolsbee, I think, or maybe the other Goolsbee, and myself. I think that was about it.
Yeah.
In that office, So that's all I know.
Okay.
The financial controller. Can I just turn off that machine? That's who I was dancing with. It was Fergus Brennan, I think.
Yeah. He went on to manage Jerry Mosel afterwards,
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Jerry Houlihan is dead. Wait a minute, who else was there?
Mr. Egan.
Oh, Pat Egan, he was secretary. And before him was Jerry Crawford. And Jerry Crawford, you couldn't get a new pencil until you brought him back the old stub of the pencil. Until one day Dad got his pencil and broke it in two and says, there's me stub there. Can I have a new pencil? But it shows you didn't waste anything in those days. But it was a bit silly.
It's gas, but everything was minded then. Everything was carefully...
nothing was wasted. I mean, I was reading a history of Emily and Louise that were married to the Earl of Leinster and lived in Carton House. They wrote across the page and then they wrote downwards to save paper. And even though they were quite rich... not a scrap was ever thrown out. A tiny bit left over to do for message of lighting or something. So it was the same principle.
But the premises we're in here, your own workshop, is right beside the family home.
No, this isn't our family home. They moved up here when there was only the two of them left at home. They bought this house just because their other house was bigger. And it was too big for the two of them, so they moved up here. So Mum's been only here about 25 years, thereabouts.
Okay.
They lived in Orchard House.
Okay.
Right, just down
from. And did you look after them?
Well, I do now, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And how is your mother?
She's okay. 95.
Yeah. And I must say, to come here and just to talk to you about what you had to say was lovely, and I appreciate you talking to me, Anne.
Okay.
Thank you.